Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Richard St. John. Richard St. John's first book of poems, The Pure Inconstancy of Grace, was published in 2000 from each perfected name.
Sure will.
Okay.
Glad to do it. Thank
okay.
you. I'm going to start with a poem kind of about our human need, our longing to be renewed, to see things afresh, born from above, as one passage has it, but not in some narrow fundamentalist way, but over and over again all our lives. This is also a poem kind of about going home to visit family. So there are three characters: my mother, who's been having long decline from Alzheimer's, my sister with Down syndrome and living in the same place for like 50 years, and our family cat, named after the 18th century British poet Christopher Kit Smart. And Smart was in a madhouse for 7 years with religious mania for, among other things, making his friends pray with him in the streets. But while I was there, he wrote a long poem, and the part that everybody sees is in praise of his cat, who gave him a lot of solace while he was there. So here's the poem, Second Birth, and it starts with an epigraph. I would as lief pray with Kit Smart as with any man. Samuel Johnson. My mother is upstairs, in her bedroom crammed with tracts and books on prayer. My sister with Down syndrome is up there, too. Their voices filter through the cheap construction. Not words. It's mostly tone. Though I manage to hear, Mother, you have to put the drops in your eyes. They go back and forth. A gusty wind. The intimate, incomprehensible language of childhood twins. Tonight, everything seems to be speaking to my blindness and need. Her weekly pillbox, its mornings and evenings making one day. That childish cross-stitch of a lamb. Even our old cat, Kit Smart, throws himself down on the fake flagstone flooring, beseeching me to pray. Mewp, mewp, he says. All I catch is tone. My mother and sister are still going on. 20 minutes it's been. No, really, 50 years. Their shared laboring converges as our mom grows young again. This may seem a little strange, my sister told me on the phone. Sometimes we make animal sounds. Moo, moo. Ba, ba. The drops are still not in, but the voices come through the thin drywall, less a dispute than a well-worn vaudeville act. Tendentious at times, yet they're clearly yucking it up. Mewp, mewp, says Kit Smart, his glowing eyes at the foot of the sofa bed. Mewp, mewp, I reply. This next poem kind of explores what I take to be one of the major themes of this book, the kind of beloved fragility that we all carry with us. It's the last of three poems in the book that are about Pluto. In 2006, the International Astronomers Union voted to demote Pluto from its status as a planet. It wasn't big enough to count anymore. And at the same time, I was brooding about the wonderful literary critic George Steiner's fixation on works of high genius. And yes, I kind of thought, you know, we need and treasure the creators of high genius, the Beethovens, the Da Vincis, the Dantes, and the scientists, Einstein and Copernicus. But what about the rest of us? What about us ordinary people? And one of the ordinary people that appears in the poem is a woman we call in our neighborhood the Lady with Three Dogs, and she gets to be the star of the title poem of the book. But this poem's called Pluto 3. I'm making my usual orbit through the neighborhood. Pockmarked surface of the sidewalk aggregate. Unexpected flare of tulips in a weedy lot. Motions of the residents. Girl I've never seen with headphones, lost in some music of the spheres. Mr. Washington, thick-rimmed glasses on, coming through his chain-link gate, followed by his baggy-trousered, sulking son. No one disputes Copernicus, his diagram of circles, epicycles, equants, no more elegant than Ptolemy's. No one disputes Kepler, astrologer and mystical Pythagorean who got ellipses right. But Tombach, poor Clyde Tombach, that's a different order of magnitude. Surely would have found Pluto without him. Then, too, he'd seen those UFOs. Still, you've got to love him for those lonely years of night poring at his photographic plates. No one argues either for my neighbor Reege, who sets up a barrel telescope on his front stoop, rarely seeing much in the litter of our city lights. No one argues for the lady with three dogs, down to one dog now, a wavering, dingy moon she carries half the time. I'm back to the rental block, a dimming galaxy of dandelion puffs floating at its unmowed front. Arc of a bus that leans around a corner, trailing plumed exhaust. Boy on his bike, late to get home as dusk and the headlights start to come. Street lamps now, couples with ice cream cones, glitter of broken glass. This next poem kind of continues in something of a scientific vein at my popularized level of comprehension, and it draws on this notion that from quantum physics that particles, when they become entangled, can continue to affect each other over incredible, impossible distances. And Einstein hated this idea. He dismissed it as spooky action at a distance. One other detail, I just love the names of these subatomic particles, quarks. They have up, down, top, bottom, strange, charm, and they keep finding more of them. This is one of the darkest poems in the book, written for a friend whose son died suddenly in the prime of life. And I imagine my friend alone in a dark room playing piano. The moon, the stars, the missing mass. Above, the merest hairline fracture of a moon. Beyond, the cold, cracked glass, the terrible non-pattern of the stars. Somewhere among the sudden, wheeling absence of your sun. Wafer-thin dimensions, weightless quarks. Spooky action at a distance. Odd entanglements. You're playing Bach in total darkness. Ice whispers in the cold cloud chamber of your whiskey glass, leaving its afterimage in the varnish, pale nebula, indelible white ring. Sip of whiskey, black keys, white keys, whisperings. Spooky action at a distance, this haunting counterpoint across so many years. Down, up, bottom, top, strange, charm. Whiskey and cold glass. 90% of mass is somewhere else. Call it dark matter. Unearthly gravitas. Up, down, strange, charm. Love that cannot change a thing. Reverberations, resonance. Cold as whiskey's fire. Indelible, ineffable as Bach, yet heavy as an ache. Filling the unseen, fractures, fissures, everywhere.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Richard St. John. He's reading from his new book, Each Perfected Name. Well, that's a beautiful poem you
Thank
just
you.
Read. That phrase that you mentioned, that Einstein phrase, spooky action at a distance, is so cool.
Yeah.
And I love how you seem to always have some kind of science or, you know, so-called, in quotes, higher learning in your poetry. And can you talk about that instinct that you have, or maybe it's not an instinct, but that what leads you to always have that in your work?
Well, I confess that I worry about that a little bit, but I guess that's, you know, maybe I have a boring life, and so a lot of what has happened, a lot of what happens that's of interest to me is, you know, things that I'm reading, things that, you know, things that are one might call life of the mind. But I'm a big believer that the life of the mind is very much a piece of the life of the heart. As Blake says, a tear is an intellectual thing. And so I think we're all of us as poets following the things that interest us and that are seem to be important to us. But I always hope, that there's always some kind of emotional through line in the poems.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, the first thing I wrote down when you started reading was tenderness. You know, I mean, there's so much feeling and compassion in your work. Can you talk about that other phrase that you mentioned, the beloved fragility that we all carry with us? Are you saying that's the main thrust of this book?
Well, you know, one doesn't necessarily set out to, you know, write a book that's about something, but after you, when you start pulling it together, you sort of see what your obsessions have been over the last decade or so, mm-hmm. And I think that's one of them. And I think a companion theme to that would be not just our sort of beloved fragility, but also the mysterious kind of light that we carry with us as people, our glistening possibilities, and that's kind of behind the poem I chose as the title poem for the book, which is too long to read here today. Mm-hmm. But in the poem, Ash Wednesday is an important element, and it's an elegy for the lady with three dogs who I mentioned, and she was a Catholic. And, you know, we all know that on Ash Wednesday, you see people walking around with a smudge of ash on their foreheads put there with a fingerprint, and what's less obvious is that the ash is mixed with this sort of glistening, anointing oil. And I feel that's kind of where we find ourselves, somewhere between this rough ash and the sort of glistening of possibility. And I picked that poem because Helen, that was the name of the lady with three dogs, I think she kind of captured that.
Hmm. Were you planning on reading that poem?
No, afraid it's way too long.
Oh, that's the long one.
Yeah, that's the long one.
Too bad. It sounds really good. But yeah, okay, could you read some more?
Sure. I'm going to turn back to another poem about my mother, and I mentioned that, you know, she had a long decline from Alzheimer's. But of course, as you said, this poem's kind of about other things too, and in this one, my sense is it's, you know, kind of the way that the divine can appear in even the sort of messy moments of human intimacy. This poem's called Yet Another Resurrection Appearance. Now that she's gone to live in another land of deep attunements and forgetfulness, I'm bathing my mother for the first time. She sits, still in sweatpants, on a metal stool in her shower stall. I work downward with an old soft cloth, cupping up warm water with my other hand. First, the knot of her neck, then her back, a mottled brown, the wing-like bones of her shoulder blades. Next, I soap the tender cup of her clavicle. Her breasts now, almost gone, loose and gently leathery. So thin, her ribs seem to count themselves through her skin, and the scar where they made the incision is smoother than a dime. Now that I've laved the silvery water on her skin, touched the bones of her wrists, the hollows of her palms, now that I've set my hand into the cusp, smooth beneath each of her ghostly arms, how could I not believe? Well, you mentioned the sort of intellectual element of the poems, and I mentioned being nervous about it, but I thought in a crass effort to endear potential readers to this book, I'd read a poem about Aristotle, actually kind of written for a friend, Rick Lowe, who won one of the Genius Awards recently for his art and community work in Houston. And when I went to visit him, I was really taken with the language they used when they were playing dominoes on the little front stoops of their of what they call project row houses. And this poem also kind of explores the tension between two equally true aspects of being human. People as rational, choice-making beings who are able to shape themselves and their world, or seen another way, people as something much more intuitive and relational. Aristotle would go for the former, but it's called Irrefutable Logic of the Tiles for Rick Lowe. Yet my good friend's life was saved by Aristotle and his disciple Arthur, who taught from memory the logic and ethics in a burned-out Houston warehouse among the flattened cardboard boxes and piles of crumpled clothes, hands twitching from the vodka and amphetamines. And Rick, no books in his own home either, would sneak into the library to check, finding that Arthur had it right, down to the nuance and the numbered line. Though Arthur also disappeared, leaving behind the cardboard palette and the clothes, and troubling doubts about entelechy and power of the mind. The bright, immutable tiles of the stars aren't yet out over Houston. Only twilight August sky, above the liquor billboards and the vacant lots. Over the generous urban acre, Rick has helped rebuild. A row of shotgun houses and a juke joint down the block, restored. Breezy cottonwoods. The crunch of limestone gravel in the shared backyards. On one wooden stoop, Rick and three old friends crack jokes and calculate in multiples of five. The slap of dominoes, the hard, irrefutable logic of the tiles, brute chance or fate of 5 and 20, 15, 5. Arthur's old lessons in memory, the stoic virtues, and stern choice. But that's not the feel of it, each small tally adding to the house of scores. As the unforgiving sun goes down, evening coolness settles on. Rick is forced to knock. Ella, Stella, Della, Johnson calls. The easy clink and click as they create another day's odd, fragile shape from the bone pile. It takes a special eye to see beyond the streetlights, but overhead now reappear the fiery, courageous, twitchy little stars. And no one seems to care if they're divisible by five.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Richard St. John, reading from his new book, Each Perfected Name. I want to say, I keep thinking about the, like, sort of bravery of intimacy of your poems. It, you know, as a listener, I feel you going into difficult places with you know, a lot of bravery. The poem about bathing the mother, I thought, was amazing, and I, you know, it's so close to, I don't know, whatever is human about us, that light that you were talking about. I guess I'd like to ask you again to go back to, you talked about the light and the glistening that we all have, and can you say a little bit more about that? What that is, or what you think that is?
Well, I'm hesitant to talk about it because it's one of those things that I don't know. I feel like I see all around us the way we're all broken in some ways as people. You know, we all have our flaws, our cracks, our faults, and yet, you know, in anybody, if you look enough, you can see the sort of glistening of possibility. And there's no way to get at it except, as I'll go back to Blake for a minute, except when you really get down to the minute particulars, and that's where you really see it. Otherwise, you're just dealing at these levels of very broad abstraction, like saying, well, we're all made in the image of God in some way. And, you know, I can say that's true, too, but it's the minute particulars that really ring true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess terms of poetry, the I've noticed you use a lot of details with a sense of witnessing going on in your work. Would you say that's true about what goes on in your poems?
I just want to be careful, since there's a religious dimension to some of these poems. I hope people wouldn't hear your word witnessing in the classic, clunky way that gets talked about in some religious
circles. No, I'm not using
really,
it that way.
Witnessing really in the sense of, you know, trying to look at the world around us and say, you know, what's there? And sometimes it's amazing and sometimes it's heartbreaking. We need to remind ourselves of that. There's a wonderful quote from Frost, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he says something like, poetry is a way of remembering things that it would impoverish us to forget. And that's, I think, a piece of what we all as poets are trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Okay. Well, we've been talking probably at some length about this business about the intellectual aspects of poetry and how to deal with them. And I'd been reading an excerpt from Wordsworth's long poem, The Prelude, and, you know, it really struck me as meaningful and important. But then I found myself wondering, you know, is this just too much circling around in my own head? You know, am I just trapped inside here? Is this really making any difference in the real world? And I was wrestling with that, stuck walking around my neighborhood trying to think about how to make that into a poem. And I was getting nowhere until a set of friends told me a story about their old dog who was named Einstein. And of course, that got me going. So this poem is called Inner Ear. And it's kind of my response to my own answer to myself about the life of the mind. Inner Ear. He was an old dog, Einstein, gradually going blind, already deaf as a post. They found him one night, turning inexplicably in useless, lurching circles. My good friend recalls lifting him into the car, the musk of his dampened Airedale fur. But it wasn't a stroke, something rather with his inner ear. In only a week, he was back to his normal, halting walk, though with an unaccustomed, gentle look, as if he could hear again, but listen to something far beyond them now. Oh, the Lord is subtle, subtle, Einstein at a blackboard chalked with dense equations. I'm thinking of this on an aimless, circling walk, thinking of Wordsworth, too. Wondering if it matters that one moonlit night he steals a rowboat tied to a willow tree, then rows with adolescent hubris toward a far fixed point. Suddenly, a huge peak, black and huge, rises in his sight, strides after him and turns him back, leaving just a dim and undetermined sense of unknown modes of being. That's when, from the rolled-down window of a slate-gray SUV, a man leans out, his wife in a sari. The tunnel, it is blocked entirely. They need directions, not poor Wordsworth turning round his boat. So I talk them through a route. Yet, however practical their plea, they're looking for the Hindu temple, its tower, a ziggurat, glowing gold and white above the interstate. A realm of deities unknown to me. I find one in a book, who on his journey toward enlightenment is told he cannot bring his old dog with him too. The faithful beast looks up from licking at his cracked and bleeding paws and cocks his ears. Yudhisthira ponders 7 days, then picks his way as he descends the mountain path with Dharma limping at his side. But now the craggy landscape's different, as if the whole supporting universe had been, ever so subtly, bent.
Rick, we have time for some shorter poems, if you have any of those.
Sure. Well, as I've been saying over and over again ad nauseum here, it's complicated being human, and We rarely achieve the moments of peace that we'd like to have, real mindfulness. And then when we get them, we can't hold on to them. So what do we do? This poem is called Helsinki Accord. It's set in a park in Finland. The air, swept clean by long July light. The light, powdery gravel on the path. The silver and green leaves washing above. Here in Helsinki, I've been learning to count again. Uden, Kaden, Kolmen. To say dog and cat. Meeting a mother like and yet unlike my own, stouter and with a face more round. Maybe it takes the sieve of a foreign language to simplify and clean. Maybe it takes the silence of 7 winter months, the heavy stones of dark. I tell myself that I can keep this intimate accord, written though it is on fragile parchment light. But don't we always break these vows? The promise of morning, the high blue dome of noon, the bread of clouds, the shallow cup worn in a granite step. Still, I open up the wrapper from a pastry, boiled egg and butter, salt, not sweet, and unfold it on this weathered bench, preparing even now to break and eat. Here's another poem set in a park closer to home. I've been reading the great 20th century Hebrew poet Yehuda Amichai, this wonderful poem called Here, and it was just so complex and humane and lovely. And I said, this is just so beautiful. And then I went out on a little walk and I saw some other things too. After reading Amichai's poem called Here, I walked past the girls' softball practice. Scattering of fireflies, cool in evening air. Green expanse of grass. Fragile brown planet of infield, glowing beyond in shadowless ball field light. Lazy plink of bats, all easy and genial. Ripple of laughter, little rills of talk. A slender blonde girl stretches in slow motion to make a catch. Which kind of beauty is worth more? And what kind of counting would dare to ask?
The poetry of Richard St. John. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.